Welcome to the True Falls Film Festival.
Welcome to the True Falls podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofelt. In this episode, we're bringing you a conversation from this year's Field Sessions, True Falls's annual conversations, or our twist on the panel. This field session features Polin Lee, a social worker and trauma therapist and participant in the film Island of the Hungry Ghosts. She sat in conversation with Anand Patwardhan, director of the film Reason. Both of these films screened at True Falls 2019. Patwardhan has been making documentaries on the socio-political reality of India for decades. His latest film, a 4-hour and 20-minute epic titled Reason, chronicles India's shift from a secular democracy toward Hindu nationalism. In this conversation, taken from a field session called Within Reason, Patwardhan and Lee discuss the difficulties and importance of dissent.
If you reflect back on Reason, just the film Reason, do you find that it has been, your life work has been headed towards this film, or has this film emerged in more recent times for you?
I mean, this film has emerged in recent times in the last 4 years, but if you look at all my earlier work, I think you'd see a connection in through all of them. It's almost like one long film made over 40 years. Mm-hmm. Because every film in some way or the other leads to the next one. Yeah. It is interconnected. Mm-hmm. And so, because I'm documenting the political reality of India, mm-hmm. and so you would find similar themes in many of the films. Yeah, I mean, I think everybody must be in the dark. I mean, I should give you a little bit of a background. I mean, the heart of the film is about the killing of 4 rationalists in India that have happened over the last 4 or 5 years. People who were fighting for reason, against superstition, against religious takeover, and these people were murdered. So Their stories are central to the film, but the film also weaves in a lot of other things that are going on in the country at the same time, mm-hmm. like people being lynched for what they eat, people being killed because they're suspected of having eaten beef or killed a cow, and things like that, and people being attacked for their caste, because they're fighting against the caste system. So all of these things are part of the story. Mm. And students who are fighting against these things being called anti-national. People are being attacked for... People like me would be considered anti-national. Although in our view, we uphold the constitution of the country and the spirit of the constitution. Mm.
It's quite a title.
And the people who are attacking us, the right wing that I'm talking about, were the people who supported the British when they were in power. They were not people who fought for India's independence. They murdered Mahatma Gandhi. They refused to fly the national flag in 1947. They wanted their saffron Hindu flag. And so on. So it's a terrible irony that they have now adopted nationalism and they're calling everybody else anti-national.
Well, where are you now in the film?
Oh, right now I'm in the battle to show the film in India because the film is very difficult to show at this moment, mm-hmm. Officially. I mean, in fact, officially it can't be shown. We're doing underground screenings, yeah, wherever possible. Mm-hmm. By underground, I mean people who are invited to the screenings. That's not advertised, it's just a surprise event where we get fairly large audiences, but we can't talk about it, so I've asked my media friends not to write about it.
Yes.
Till such time as I'm ready to actually put it out, maybe on the internet.
When you say it can't officially be shown, what structures are in place to stop it being shown?
Well, this is true of no matter which government was in power, but we have a censor board. It's actually called euphemistically called the Central Board of Film Certification, because they didn't like the word censorship. But actually, it's a censor board. And so every film made technically has to go to this panel, and they pass it. They give you a U certificate or an A certificate, or they ask for cuts.
Okay.
And no matter which government was in power, I always had trouble with the censor board. They always asked for cuts, not always, but most of the time. And I took them to court and won my battles, and I never allowed them to actually cut anything because I won my court battles. It took wasted a lot of time. But when the right-wing government comes to power, and it is in power right now, whenever they have come, things have become much harder. So it's difficult to win a court case while they're in power because the courts are scared of them.
And given that there's this very clear structure of censorship in India, does that influence the way that you approach a film when you're first thinking about it, particularly in relation to Reason?
No, not because when I've been making films for more than 40 years, and as I said, I never allowed them. We won every battle against the censor board and against the national television would refuse to show the films. And we won those battles. We actually forced the national television to show the films 5 times.
Yes.
We won 7 court cases, including in the Supreme Court. So so that confidence I have that I could win these battles in court, because there's nothing in my films that is against the Constitution of India. But as I said, with the present right-wing government, it's not just the legality that we're worried about. It's actually, you know, they have extra legal means of doing things.
And I was curious that when you talk about, at this stage, you're fighting the battle to have the film seen.
Yeah.
Are you engaged with a team that helps around fighting to have it screened, or is this something that you kind of lead yourself?
I mean, over the years, I'm virtually became a lawyer because we've fought so many court cases. But I had a friend who passed away a year and a half ago, but he fought all my court cases and he won them all. We won 5 cases in the High Court, 6 cases in the High Court and 1 in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court somebody else fought, but yeah, it was amazing. And our cases were not exactly easy cases. We fought censorship on the grounds of my freedom of expression and the public's right to information. And then we also fought cases against the national television, because the TV would always say no to the broadcast. But in the earlier days, some of my films won national awards. The government has a jury and they give national awards every year. And some of my films won the national awards. So we could use that and go to court and say, the government gave me this award, so how come the government is saying you can't show the film on a government channel? And we won all those court cases, and the films had to be shown at prime time. At the moment, we're playing it by ear. We don't know what we're doing exactly, but we're taking a slight amount, as minimum a risk as possible, by not inviting those who might go and make a big noise about it. So that ends up limiting. I mean, we're preaching to the choir, but we're showing the film to people who already are on our side. I mean, there's a little bit of spillover, and that's the risky part.
Yes. When you talk,
but we've been hoping that in the next, the elections are around the corner, in a month and a half, and we were hopeful that we could actually turn it over and defeat the government, but that's looking unlikely now because they have managed to get the country into a war, and that always helps the right wing.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about underground screenings or screenings that are by invite only, can you, because of the imagery in the film of really showing so much about Indian society, can you describe to us what one of these screenings would look like? Where would it be held and how would people come to know about it?
I don't want to, I mean, if this is going out in the public, then I don't want to talk too much about how we do it. But we have managed to do it in, I mean, there are many venues where you can show these films where people are happy to see them. Mm. And there is a resistance movement in the country. Mm. There are people who are opposed to what's happening. Mm-hmm. So they're happy for such a film to exist and happy to see it. We have no trouble getting in a big audience.
And when these screenings happen, what are the kind of conversations that happen after the screening? What kind of response or feedback have you been receiving?
Well, the typical response is that it's nice that you've shown it to us, but we're already on your side, so how are you going to show it to everybody else who's against us? Mm-hmm. And that question I haven't been able to answer yet.
Mm-hmm. Does it bring energy to the resistance movement, a film like this?
Yeah, I think it brings energy for sure. But it more than that, I think it helps clarify the argument. Because many people have seen different elements that are in the film. The film is 4 hours long. Mm. So some things are known to people. Maybe everything is known as a newspaper headline. But yes, it hasn't been strung together. And things that look like they're random, because they happen sporadically and all over the country. Mm. But in a film that's put together and there's a logic behind what's happening. Mm-hmm. So I think people understand what the logic is. And that this experiment with right-wing Hindu fundamentalism is more than 100 years old. Mm. It's been in preparation since the British were in India.
Mm-hmm. Given that the film does span across 100 years of history, why is it so significant and important to be pulling all these random events together?
Because the most people today are brought up on watching television and news. Is people don't even read the newspapers much, and the news, both the electronic media and the print media, are very much controlled by corporates that have thrown in their lot with the right wing. Mm-hmm. So the news is very, I wouldn't even say it's consciously, it's not even like, we had a period of emergency in 1975 where they actually declared an emergency and newspapers were not allowed to write criticism of the government. Mm-hmm. It doesn't operate like that now. Mm-hmm. It operates because they have people in places that are sympathetic to the right wing point of view. So newspapers and the electronic media is voicing what the government wants to hear. Mm-hmm. Not even the government, but the right-wing ideology that drives the government. Mm-hmm. The government is one thing, but there is a non-government body called the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, yes, that is about 100 years old. Mm-hmm. And it's groups like that they don't have to follow the constitution. They're not a political party even by definition. Mm. They're a cultural body. Mm. But they determine ideology. Most of their people are in power right now. Mm-hmm. And in the media plays that game. So whether they do it consciously or because they've been now in the last 5 or 6 years, they've become used to the understanding that this is what nationalism is.
Coming up after the break, Lee and Patwardhan discuss the democratic power of documentaries. First, a word from our sponsor. Hey, listeners, it's Allison, letting you know that this episode of the True/False podcast is brought to you by the University of Missouri. And that is, in fact, where we are sitting right now in the KBIA studios at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. We're here with Ryan Vermeulener, news director for KBIA and assistant professor of journalism, and he is going to tell us a little bit about the Missouri Method. Hey.
Hey, what's up?
Nothing. Just want to know about the Missouri Method. What is that?
So anytime you ask a journalism professor here about that, they always use analogies for it. And one of my favorite ones that someone at the Missouri in the newspaper that operates the journalism school said
once was... Oh, you got a newspaper?
Yeah, we got a newspaper and a TV station, radio station. But this newspaper editor was like, it's kind of like you're an air traffic controller, but none of the pilots have their licenses. Because we cut students loose. We just let them go crazy in actual professional newsrooms. And when I go to public radio conferences and tell them that we have 70 to 100 journalism students working in our newsroom as reporters, anchors, show hosts, producing podcasts like this one you're listening
like
to right
one.
Now.
Yeah.
These people look at me like I'm crazy because they're like, you give that kind of control to people that you don't know if you can trust? And it's like, yeah, we do. And it's kind of like, you push the bird out of the nest, right? And yes, lots of them do fall flat on the ground, and that's fine, and that's part of it. And I'd rather them fall flat on the ground here than out in the world.
True.
But a lot of them fly, right? And they do. We've had students win national professional awards competing against professionals for stories
as
that
students.
They've done here. Yeah, as students.
Yeah.
And they win all the student awards. They win, like, all the student awards, too. But even professional awards, Edward R. Murrow Awards, students have them on their resume before they leave here at the University of Missouri. It's crazy.
Welcome back to the True/False podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofeldt. Let's get back to the conversation between Anand Patwardhan and Polin Lee. Patwardhan has been fighting to show his film Reason in India, but has been stymied by government censorship. Now he discusses the role documentaries can play in the fight for democracy.
In a way, documentary filmmaking is a way of breaching those divides, because as a filmmaker, I can go to any community or that will welcome me or that I make friends with, and they're not necessarily my community. I could do my community as well. Mm. In fact, I find it harder to do my community because they know what I'm doing. they know what I'm doing in the sense that they know that they're going to be the villains of the piece. so they're a little bit wary. But a documentary, I think, is a democratic device because it's carrying people's voices across. It's starting a conversation that is not happening in real life, mm-hmm. between the Hindu and the Muslim, between upper caste and lower caste, and male and female, all kinds of divides. But a documentary that tries to connect everybody and hears everybody, and then when you see it, then it's a kind of indirect communication.
Mm. That's
a conversation
really
that's not happening in everyday life.
It just leads me to another question, and then I'll see how everyone else is going for questions. But I guess I was really curious that in the film you highlight the risk of speaking out. In four people's case, they're killed for speaking out. But there's also a risk to not speaking out. And I just wondered if you wanted to speak a little bit about how you see risk.
The risk of not speaking out in India right now is that you allow fascists to come to power. It's a risk of risk that the people in Germany took when Hitler was coming to power. Mm. And they suffered for it. They finally got these guys in power that wouldn't leave, mm-hmm. without a war and complete destruction. Mm-hmm. So had more people spoken out at that time, we wouldn't have had Hitler. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the collective risk that people are taking when they silence themselves. Mm-hmm. There is a personal risk of speaking, but there's a collective risk of being silent.
Of being silent, yeah. So it's not always a choice, yeah?
Yeah.
Or an individual choice.
Yeah. And luckily, many people are instinctively unable to keep quiet.
Yeah. Thank goodness.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really have appreciated the conversation with you, and I'd love to just see if anyone else has some sure. questions before we finish up today.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the, I guess, left or the movement that you're sort of a part of and like other projects that are happening, or is it still pretty rare that this type of critical filmmaking or critical storytelling is happening in India right now, or is that starting, have you seen that grow, I guess, over time?
No, it's happening quite a lot, and it's happening partly because the medium has become democratized in the sense that the equipment is cheaper, people can afford it, you can make a film on your own computer with your own tiny camera. And even so-called deprived sections of society are learning to make their own films, and they don't necessarily get widely seen, but they're getting made right now. So there will come a time when they will be seen widely as well, more widely. I mean, to the extent that documentaries are seen widely at all, which is not a great extent.
So, I'm not an expert or anything, but I know that India has pretty deep cinematic tradition going back a long time.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you see yourself as...
Almost as old as Lumiere. We had a Dadasaheb Phalke who had his own little machine, and it was soon after Lumiere that they were making films already in India.
Sure. So I was just wondering if you consider yourself an Indian filmmaker, and if so, who your sort of influences are that are Indian?
I never thought of it like that. As I said, I never set out to be a filmmaker even. I wasn't drawn to cinema for aesthetic reasons. For me, it was a way of communicating what I was doing. So I think my political or social understanding was what took me to cinema as an instrument of doing that more effectively, especially in a country where literacy rates are not high. So the audiovisual medium was a powerful way of telling stories and communicating. And what I said earlier about deepening the democracy in a sense of by carrying voices from one place to another.
That's all for this episode of the True False podcast. Thank you for coming to True False 2019 and for supporting us from wherever you are. Thanks to Mitch Legan for producing this episode with help from Betsy Smith and Sebastian Martinez Valdivia. Our music was created by Tim Pilcher using sounds from the True False Film Fest. I'm Allison Kofeldt. Thanks for listening.